QSO Today, episode 496, Erod Deutsch 4Z1AC. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. I want to thank Joey Smith, N4VFA, who became a regular monthly sponsor, and Howard Dittmer, NZ5U, for his generous donation of $105 that renewed his annual sponsorship. There is a scam from China where you receive a formal email from the China Internet Registry, where you are told that there is a business entity in China that wants to use your trademarked logo and name for their use in China, unless you register now for about $350 US. Thanks to Google, I discovered that this is a common scheme and that I could register my QSO Today trademark as China Registered Domains on GoDaddy for about $25 total. Now my QSO Today domains that end in .cn are forwarded to the main QSO Today website. As a public service announcement, be sure to do some research on quote-unquote official messages from foreign entities. Of course, your support of QSO Today at any level helps to protect QSO Today and keep it on the air. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Uth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio, do people still do that?" this podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. If you are new to the QSO Today podcast, please be sure to look at the QSOtoday.com website, where we have almost 500 interviews with amateur radio operators. From there, you can click on links that take you to the QSO Today Academy. Our catalog contains over 500 videos on every ham radio subject, completely searchable. Erod Deutsch, 4Z1AC, is a high-tech entrepreneur and creator of Vera AC HF Digital Mode to create a fast, stable, and accurate messaging system for regular and emergency communications. Like many of us hams, Erod became an amateur radio operator as a teenager growing up in Israel, whose license to learn and the experience that he gained opened the doors to his technical success. Join 4Z1AC in this QSO Today. 4Z1AC, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Erod?
4Z1UG, this is 4Z1AC. Loud and clear, 59, go ahead.
Erod, thanks so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Well, I need to go back like long time. I'm 46, not that long, but still. when I was at the age of 12, I was looking for, you know, some spare time hobby. And I had plenty of hobbies already. I had piano, I had chess, I was a bird watcher, but that one, I want electronics, but that hobby timing was colliding with some other hobbies. So my mom said, "You know what? Have you heard about ham radio?" I said, "What's ham radio?" She told me, "A good friend of ours, their son is a ham radio. Go check out what he has there in his," I didn't even know the name, shack, right? But in his room. So we went there. I was fascinated, and I signed up for, you know, a class of ham radio at the age of 12. That's how it started. And I've been doing ham radio ever since.
I can't let you just write off all of those years. So let's go back a little bit. The hometown is?
I was born in the southern part of Israel in a city called Beersheba. It's about 100 kilometers south from Tel Aviv, where everyone knows. There is a nice ham radio society over there, by the way, still active.
As I recall, it's a group that kind of gets together every week and has coffee.
Yes, yes, yes. I never went to those coffee. I was a child, and they were, you know, very...
They were older guys.
Sure. But I was always active on the VHF repeaters. So I was the one who called me at the night watcher of the VHF repeater. I made sure it is, you know, the money spent was well spent with the southern repeaters back then.
So you're 12 years old. Your mom kind of brings up this idea of ham radio. And you went to a young man. Did he become a friend and mentor to you in amateur radio?
No, he was about maybe at the age of 15, just older than me. But there was a class in Be'er Sheva for ham radio that was run by a guy who I admire. His name is Danny Sadan. He's a 4X1 Mike Juliet. he was my mentor. He was my tutor. I learned everything from him. So I was, you know, one student in his class, but I think I'm the only one who kind of took it away to the next level. And we're still in great in touch, and we meet every now and then.
You talk about piano and chess. You're a well-rounded individual. But did you have an interest in electronics even before ham radio?
Well, I got those, you know, kits that my dad used to buy, where you can solder things and get some cool stuff. By the way, I find myself doing it with my young daughter, who is 12 years old, by the way. She's not into ham radio, but we do Arduino together. So, yeah, I was always fascinated with soldering and making things, putting things together. But ham radio was something I wasn't even aware of. I didn't know it existed back then.
So Danny was your mentor in ham radio. And how important was that mentorship to kind of move you along to ham radio success?
It was super valuable, truly. I really admire the person. He really put a lot of effort into educating all of us about not only the technical parts, but also connect us to the hobby, pouring in also the human side of the hobby, not only the technical part of it. I was ashamed that I actually failed him, because everybody passed the first test. I was his best student and I failed on the first test.
Maybe that was just nerves, you know, expectations.
Yes, I'm sure. And after I passed the test, he took me under his wing, and he lived nearby. So I was able to go to his shack and operate, and he showed me all the stuff. And, you know, he was a grown up. He was, you know, at my age, 40 something at that time. I was 12. And I felt like he's my best friend. He connected me as we met, and as I saw more things, and he had this cool things that through telephone he could do radio and stuff. I was fascinated by all this. And then at some point, I got my own shack. My father decided that it looks promising and I'm very serious into this. So he bought me the fanciest transceiver money could buy back then in Israel, which was a TS-850 from Kenwood. Maybe the 950 is fanciest, but 850, we went to that shop. He said, "What's the best radio money can buy? I want this for my son." And that's how I started my own shack.
Okay, so your first rig was a Kenwood TS-850. And as I recall, the Kenwood dealer was the Volvo dealer in Tel Aviv, right?
Correct. I was there. I met this guy.
I met him as well some years ago. But what was interesting, I think, in those days was in order to become a ham radio dealer, I think that the communications ministry required that he also had to have the ability to do any warranty repairs as well.
I don't remember. I don't know, because this rig is still operating very well in my shack.
Is that right?
Yeah. I replaced the capacitors like two years ago, but that's it. Just a few.
Okay, so you have this TS-850. What kind of antenna did your parents allow you to put on the house? Were you in like a cottage, or were you in a freestanding house?
Yeah, so at the first location, first QDH, we were at a cottage, and I had there, my first antenna was a dipole 5 Benders, which did a terrific job, but then I needed more. And my father is a mechanical engineer. He's super talented. He's the CTO of the Dead Sea factories, and he builds factories, so he knows how to build stuff. So he decided that I need a huge mask and a huge antenna. So we bought the A4S from Cushcraft, which is for a 4 Bender Yagi. And then we had a mast, which was like 18 meters high, telescopic.
For the uninitiated, that's like 52 feet. It's actually quite a tall mast.
It's huge. And when we moved my parents moved to a new QTH, then we had to move this telescopic antenna with us. And on the other QTH, I also had the benefit to be on the top of a hill. So combine this with this antenna, then you get everywhere with 100 watts, even on, you know, on the bed Sun Cycles site. So it was amazing.
What was your favorite operating mode then in those days?
Like everyone, I started with SSB. I love CW. But then maybe 2 years, 3 years into the hobby, I started to shift quite drastically into digital mode. First, it was the packet times. Like everybody was doing packet radio over VHF, also on HF, but primarily on VHF. Even locally, there was a very big scene of packet radio. So I built the BICOM, by the way, with my tutor, and the BICOM modem, and I went into packet radio and BBSs and stuff. And I was fascinating by this. And very soon I started to do the same thing with HF. And I was mostly interested in those synchronous ARQ modes. Like I was maybe the first one in Israel who had a Pactro modem. I was the first one who operated, you know, modes like GTOR, like Clover, all those kind of modes. I did traditional RTTY and PSK and stuff, but those modes really made me more intrigued than the others.
You really became a keyboard user for ham radio.
Yes, I think I'm a keyboard guy in my real life, not only in ham radio.
So one of the questions I always ask with this interest in ham radio, look, beginning at 12, that meant that you had 6 years of continuing education before you went to the Army or went to college. Did ham radio play a part in your choices for your education and career after high school?
Ham radio had a huge contribution to my career, for sure, in two aspects. I was a computer geek from the age of 4. So connecting ham radio and computers was a very natural thing for me. This is one of the reasons, you know, I developed the software we're probably going to talk about today, and why I was very interested in, you know, doing keyboard to keyboard communications and not just CW or SSB, and was very fascinated with network and network protocols. So ham radio helped me to expand our understanding in this, you know, because in real life, when you talk about landlines, everything works perfectly. But with ham radio, you have different challenges that really kind of stimulate you to find creative solutions to that need to be solved. The other part of ham radio that really, really contributed to my career is that my articulation level in English helps me significantly in my business. And this was purely because I spent hours talking to Americans over SSB in the middle of the night at the age of 14, 15. I had American friends. I really polished my English into a level that better than the average Israeli, that really helps me today in business.
Do you find that amateur radio today in Israel is different than it was when you were a kid? And if it is different, how is it different?
Yes, it is. And I think it's different all around the world. But, you know, looking in my backyard, I think it's different. People nowadays do ham radio, but in a different manner. So I think, and this is one of the reasons that, you know, kind of forced me into doing what I'm doing today with ham radio. But I felt like the human touch of ham radio is evaporating slowly and surely. And people do more short type of QSOs. People exchange less ideas and less, just less words. More reports, less words. FT8 kind of shifted everything from speaking to semi-automatic QSOs. So I think it happens everywhere. It happens also in Israel. The repeaters are not as active as they used to be. We have a very, very sophisticated repeater here, both DMR and analog and echolink. They're connected together. And yet most throughout the day, there's hardly anyone talking. And that's a shame. And this is something I really want to change. And I said to myself at some point, well, what do people like nowadays? Everybody's on WhatsApp. Everybody's on TikTok. Everybody's on Facebook. They exchange ideas, but just differently. They just don't like to talk. They don't like to do SSB anymore. I don't know. Not as they used to be. So let's try and mimic the experience we have with the digital world outside of ham radio and try to create something that will keep the human-to-human touch, but just adapted to the 21st century where people don't like to talk as much as they used to do.
When you left high school, were you in the Israeli army?
Yes, I spent 6 years in the Israeli army and the intelligence force, and we did I did primarily software development and IT. So this is was like my first real step into, you know, my career, my professional career. Although, as I said, I was a computer geek from the age of four. So I did also five yechidot in computers and physics. But the real stuff started in the army. And then when I left the army, I worked for some companies all around the world, primarily with telco companies and fintech companies, extending their ITs, scaling them in terms of, I'm a data geek, so I'm a data expert. Their data infrastructure, those companies needed to extend. They want to, they hit a glass ceiling and they needed to breach it in a way. And I was there to solve their problems as a, as an advisor.
Were the relationships that you made in the army to extending your professional career?
Oh, a lot of my friends nowadays, I meet them over and over. Most of the guys I served with are running high-tech companies nowadays in multiple and disciplinaries. And we also have a gathering every week. So we see each other. We exchange ideas. We have WhatsApp groups where we exchange ideas. As you said, I have that WhatsApp group as well. But yeah, it's very significant because some of them are really good friends that I, you know, go out and have beer every now and then.
Do you find that in Israel that it's actually normal to join a company where many of the guys that you served with in the army are also people that you trust and work with in the private sector?
Yes, there's something that happens, you know, when you take a bunch of guys and you close them in a room for 3 years, for 6 years, they melt into each other in a way. Their brains becomes very much alike, their behavior, their ideas. You know, those atmospheres, especially when you put stress into this, and there's a lot of stress in an army service, it creates those bonds that never break. They may fade a little bit, but they never break. So when you go out, you see the same people, and there is always something that when you meet somebody that you haven't seen for like 20 years, and you serve together a long time ago in that server room under someplace, you have something in common, and it immediately breaks the ice, and you can exchange idea because you trust each other. You have done crazy stuff long time ago. At the age of 18, 19, we were responsible for dozens of millions of dollars of equipment, of computer equipment. There was a lot of responsibility and stress. And this created those bondings that really continues throughout life. I think it goes everywhere, even with people who served, not like myself with computers, but, you know, the Navy SEALs. They're brothers for life, right? It's the same here.
You've had your military success. You're now in the private sector. What happened after that? Where did you go?
Well, first I started I joined a small company here in Israel. It's a consultant company. So as I said, I specialize in data, databases, big data. Now I also specialize with NLP and AI. But back then it was purely around databases. I worked for a consultant company that helped companies to grow their business by scaling their infrastructure, upgrading their systems, putting in new technologies and stuff. That was a huge success. And at some point when we were like 50 guys, I was the third employee in that company. And when we got about 50, we were pretty big. We also had, by the way, a lot of projects in the United States. There was something that I found like a problem that was a common problem to many of our clients. When you have a big computerized system, if you have one single user running a huge report, like the end of the month report in the bank or something, it eats up all the resources, like all the CPU, all the IO, you know. So the only way to handle those kind of things is to buy a bigger computer. So it's like paving new lanes between Boston and New York just because you have two traffic jams, one in the morning time and one in the evening time. And it's not cost effective. So what we've built the technology, we patented it, that allows, so it's like a police officer that kind of manage the traffic and able to say, okay, your report, it's eating up a lot of resources. Instead of 1 hour, you will run for 1 hour and 30 minutes because you didn't really care. You don't sit and wait, right? You go to have your coffee, you go to see meeting. But those other people who are now serving customers, they need better, more this CPU now. So I'll redirect those resources now in real time. It was a non-intrusive solution, which was magic. And that company was a huge success. And we sold it to an American giant called EMC. It's then blended into Dell. Dell bought BSC, so it's now blended into Dell's portfolio. Dell has a big data platforms. And that was my first success in business when I sold that company.
Congratulations. You're one of thousands of Israeli success stories in high tech. I mean, who would have thought? Maybe it seems natural that Israel would become a high tech center. Do you think that this out-of-box thinking comes from, is it societal? Is it something that we do here in Israel that we don't do anyplace else?
I don't think that, you know, the being Israeli makes your idea better, right? There's great ideas all over. I go all around the world. We have great partners. I see startups. I run a small investment firm. So I also invest. And I see great ideas all over. I think the one thing that we have here, which is quite different, is because everybody in Israel has to do their service at the age of 18, the army service. And we have a lot of tech in the army. So what happens is that unlike like the average American who goes to college at the age of 18, right? We go to the army. So we get the experience after 3, 4, 5 years that is very unique. And at a very young age, when you still don't have all these, let's say, obligations in life, like a mortgage, kids and stuff, even a wife. So you're out of the service at the age of 22, 23. You have an experience of like a 35-year-old in the high tech in someplace else. And you say, let's take a risk. I don't have nothing to lose, right? I don't have a house to lose. I don't have a baby to feed. Let's take a risk and start a company because I think, and we are very arrogant at the age of 24. So we think we know everything. So we take risks. And this is why it's a very, very, it's a great foundation for startups to build. Not everybody succeed, of course, but it's a great foundation for startups.
I was a marketing vice president in Israel for a couple of high tech companies. And what I found was, there's a lot of intellectual property that's on the shelf. There's a lot of these young risk takers starting a company, building a technology, not based on marketing need, but something that they had this idea. And I think that it's this proliferation of product ideas that may not have a reality to the market on the one hand. On the other hand, every lack of success builds a success.
Yeah.
Every technology that you end up putting on the shelf, there's a piece of that that goes with the guy to the next company, and that gets implemented into the next thing. And I think that that's why there is so much high-tech innovation that's coming out of Israel, because it's built on exactly what you're saying. These 22-year-olds that have nothing to lose, that convince an investment company, a seed company, to put money in, to see where they can go. And I think that the environment, at least when I first moved here, was if that seed investor had a portfolio of 20 companies and only one was the rising star, that was okay. You know, to lose 19 and to have that one meant that there's 19 companies that are going to move their employees around to other startups. But eventually, every one of those people, unless they're just not capable, actually ends up being a part of a successful startup. You know, it might be 2 or 3 generations of startups, but they get there. And what comes out is, as a result of this thinking, is quite remarkable.
You certainly need to fail in order to succeed. Those guys who succeed, you know, on their first time, that's really rare, right? Most people fail. And, you know, you don't have to fail like close the company. I think, you know, as being an entrepreneur for so many years, I believe in the saying of fail fast, right? Do something and decide quickly if it works or if it doesn't work. Don't get in love with what you have created because you're the only one who's loving it, probably. If no one buys it, if no one's willing to hear about it, don't try to educate the market. Try to find another problem and solve it. Try to see what you have built and adopt it into a different problem. So companies that invent something pivot one, two, three times in their lifetime. So it's the same company, same guys. They just adapt themselves. And these are the guys who really make it.
The company name may change a few times. I'm actually working with a company that started in 2005 and is doing a completely different product than what they actually started out. Completely different market, completely different technology. You know, it ends up being clever and it takes a long time, but you have these amazing teams, as you have mentioned earlier. So the idea of this is fail fast is, I think, is kind of how it works here, in that we're not afraid to start to begin with, which I think sometimes that's the hardest part, is just starting. And then when you see that it's not going to go, you pivot.
And by the way, when I find companies like that are looking for a seed investment, for example, or a pre-seed, one of the things that I try to see or learn about those guys is not about the technical skills or background or history. I try to challenge them with if it doesn't work, if no one buys this, if you don't find the right partner, if you don't find customers, if this technology doesn't work, what are we going to do next? So there are two type of answers there. I'll say maybe three. One, if it doesn't work, I will have to close the company, right? It's a risk. It's an investment. You have to understand this as an investor. That's number one. The number two is, well, we'll try to pivot. We'll see. I think it's also applicable to this domain and this domain. We're going to focus here, but I have a B plan or a C plan to go someplace else.
And now this break. The QSO Today project that includes this podcast and the QSO Today Academy is now listener-sponsored. There are no commercial sponsors who influence the content and opinions expressed on QSO Today, including my blog posts. Disclaimer, we did not have a problem with sponsor influence when we did have commercial sponsors. The world is different now. I believe that commercial sponsorship, where you watch and listen to TV, radio, YouTube, Facebook, and X for free, does give sponsors complete control over all that you see and hear. The largest networks are now dominated by international corporations who decide in their boardrooms what we hear, know about, how we vote, and what we buy. Commercial sponsorship models for podcasts don't work, maybe for good reasons. At QSO Today, we are back to blogging and podcasting for the free expression of ideas, discussion, and the dissemination of content without commercial sponsorship. It takes everyone's ideas and approaches in our discussions to formulate our own way with the best information available. This has always been the best formula for success, even in ham radio. So QSO Today is now value for value, following the model created by another ham, Adam Curry, K5AAC, inventor of podcasting and the value for value business model. I create valuable amateur radio content that you consume. In return, you find it valuable, then you reward the podcast with your sponsorships, donations, transcription sponsorships, and using the QSO Today Amazon link. Your supporting the podcast in this way keeps QSO Today podcast coming to you every week since July of 2014, now approaching 500 episodes. In addition, we have over 500 educational ham radio videos from previous QSO Today virtual ham expos that we also publish to allow every ham to benefit from these excellent presentations. However, all of this content has to be produced, edited, curated, and hosted on commercial platforms by me and my team to keep it easily accessible and available to you. Links and banners on the show notes pages allow you to show your support of the QSO Today project. Please support QSO Today with your sponsorships, donations, and using our Amazon links. And now back to our QSO Today. Let's go to the present. You have on QRZ beautiful pictures of your ham shack.
Well built by my wife, by the way. Compliments to my wife.
It's not quite as beautiful as yours, but I have a beautiful office ham shack. I've discovered for me it's such a huge distraction, because when I should be working, I want to play on the radio.
Tell me about it.
So I saw your pictures on QRZ, and I'll share the pictures with the audience on the QSO Today website. I'm looking at that, I'm laughing because I can imagine trying to work in such a beautiful ham shack as that. But let's talk, first of all, what is the rig today? How is your ham shack outfitted now?
All right. Although I'm very deeply invested into ham radio, I don't have the fanciest rig. The reason is because I'm also a car enthusiast. You can have the best engine, but the tires makes most of the difference on the track. My tires today, because of my current QTH, is not fancy. It's not this 18-meter high, four elements, Cushcraft. These are the tires of ham radio. I don't have good tires. I have a very nicely laid antenna, which is a dipole antenna, a two-bender only. I have those very high palm trees in my yard. So I brought this dude who climbs up there. He had shackles out there, and then I can take up and down this antenna for maintenance. So it is very high. It's 18 meter high, but it's a dipole. Very well laid northwest, southeast. So I got plenty of, you know, the US, Europe, and VK land. But it's still not the same experience as I had like 30 years ago. The reason here, where I live today, and with more people are aware of radios and radiation, because it sounds similar, right? Radio and radiation. So I don't want to have a big footprint around my neighborhood, starting people bugging me and asking questions, although it's completely legal. So I have this antenna, which is well disguised. My rig is the good old TS-850, which I use for some bands because it has a great antenna tuner. So I can tune my antenna to every band. But then my daily rig is the popular IC7300. For VHF, I have the MD9600. I have, you know, a walkie-talkie, the one from the TYT, yeah, that everybody uses. And that's about it. I have some noise blankers, modest shack. I do have all the modems that you can think of, like the Kentronics, the Pactor. I even have the new package radio. I don't know if you heard about this, the NPR modem, which is really great. Too bad I don't have anyone to play with, so I bought two to play with myself.
I want to make sure that we really spend some time on VAR-AC. Let's start there. How is it that you ended up getting to VAR-AC? With all of the digital modes, beginning with RTTY, there's all kinds of analog HF modes. And you had this interest in packet radio. This is before I arrived in Israel, that there was a packet radio VHF network that went all up and down the country.
Yes.
So any ham that was involved could actually send messages up and down the country. And then I think that went away when the ham that owned all the digipeaters went away.
Yeah, it was very popular. It was even connected through HF to the outside world.
HF gateway.
HF gateways. Also, we had a gateway through Cyprus on VHF.
So you had this interest in modem keyboard communications. Why VAR-AC with everything else? I mean, everything else seems great. What's the difference? What's the history? How did that start?
I'll start with a little bit of history. So as I said, I was a digital ham radio. This was my core. Most of my time I spent talking to other people with Pactor, for example. I had a lot of QSOs with Pactor a long time ago, 25, 30 years ago. So then, you know, I got married, my career, everything, you know, took most of my spare time. I moved between houses. I lived in Tel Aviv. I lived in Herzliya. And there were no places where I can, you know, revive this hobby. And I was busy. A few years back, like 10 years ago, we moved to a town called Savion in Israel. So, and in the 5 years ago, I had like more spare time. So I opened up all the boxes, dusted all the equipment, plugged it, and magically this TS-850 still works. I took the Pactor modem, plugged it in, and it works. And I started to call CQ like 30 years ago. Nobody answered. I started to learn about ham radio today, and I understand that everybody's on FT8, and at some point the FT4 came in, and so there's still a little bit of RTTY, there's still a little bit of PSK, but everybody's on FT8. And you can hardly hear SSB or CW. People always complain, oh, it's the propagation. All right, when there is a contest, the bands are filled with SSB and CW. It's not the propagation. It's because people are not willing to talk anymore. We became a little bit lazy, right? Even myself, I do FT8. I did BXCC with FT8. But I wanted to chat. I wanted to talk to people. I remember those old RegChu conversations 35 years ago with my fellow Americans. We talked about our hobbies. We talked about our lives. We talked about our problems. I shared my intimate problems with some of those guys. I even met some of those guys. I have a great friend from Austria who we meet every few years. This was all gone. And I say, well, Pactor Radio, I want to chat. I want to do a keyboard-to-keyboard chat. Pactor is the great mode out there that can provide you with 100% delivery with great speeds also to send like files and stuff. But it's too expensive.
Right. The Pactor modem itself was over $1,000, as I recall, right?
It's over $1,000. And now there's the Dragon 4 something. It's $1,200 even. So it's just very... So you need to schedule a QSOs on Facebook because there's a Facebook group in order to enjoy a little bit of keyboard-to-keyboard conversation. When I do PSK or when I do RTTY, it really ends up with just extending name and reports, because the QSO can break, you know, QSB. I also tried all the other, like Contessia, Olivia, right? I tried them all, and I still do them all every now and then. But if you don't have 100% guarantee, you're not spending too much time and effort to talk about the real stuff. You just do the minimum required to make the QSO valid. So you don't want to spill out your guts, and then the other side, like in SSB, right? You have a long over, and you talk like 2 minutes, and then the other say, "Oh, sorry, you faded away. There was a QSB, so I got 50." It takes all the passion of the willing to continue this conversation. So I wanted to have something that is bulletproof. At that point, I stumbled into the Vara modem. So I was like everybody else. I tried the WinLink software, which is a great software to exchange emails between radio and the IP world, and even between ham radio. I know it's highly popular with ANCOM. People make sure that they always have a viable WinLink operating just in case something bad happens. But it's not a way to communicate. It's mostly find its way into being an ANCOM-based solution. But the Vara modem, I saw a potential there. I play with WinLink a lot, so I saw that the speeds the Vara can get. I also explored that the guy who created the Vara modem, he's a great Spanish guy. His name is Jose. We're in great relationship. And he also had a small tool called the Vara Chat that kind of have a very simple terminal for chatting using Vara. It's very basic. And I asked him if he could develop a few stuff. And he didn't have the time, the effort, or the will to do this. And then it hit me. I'd say, well, the Vara protocol seems like a great protocol for keyboard-to-keyboard chat. Let's give it a shot. I grouped around about 10 guys with me on Facebook, by the way. We have a very active Facebook group. Now it's about 7.5K group. And we played with VaraChat, and at some point when it was not enough, I said, well, I'm not the best developer out there. I have great developers in my company, but I still have some tricks in my sleeve. Let me write a small terminal problem that will do what we want. So I write a small terminal C# program. I distribute it, and we started to talk to each other. That ignited a chain of events that I couldn't even imagine. From having a bunch of 10 guys doing some experiments, we are now over 50K users of VARAC. There's anything between 100 and 200 actively at any given moment. It's all reflected on PSK Reporter. So it's a huge community today. And it all started because I just wanted to chat with somebody. and the only modem that was out there was too expensive. That's the essence of why I started this.
This is very exciting to me, especially when you said IC7300. I also have a TS520 here that probably needs to be recapped. But what hardware and software do you need? When you're talking about the VARA modem, are we talking a software modem, or are we talking another expensive piece of hardware in order to interface that to the 7300, for example?
Okay, so a little bit about VARA. VARA is a software-based modem created by the talented Jose. His call sign is Echo Alpha 5 Hotel Victor Kilo. You can find it on his website. It's a brilliant piece of software that uses a hybrid modulation, anything from PSK to QPSK, and can get on HF with a 500 hertz bandwidth to up to 1.5 kbps, 1.5 kilo. Remember on the packet radio on VHF, we used to have 1.2. We're talking 1.5, 500 hertz on HF, top speed. If you want to go wider, like 2.3 kilohertz bandwidth, then it goes up to like 7K. It's like really, really magical. He also has a version for VHF and UHF. This takes us to like, you know, the 10 and the 20th thousand kind of BPS. People use VARA on via on FM quite a lot in Europe and also in the United States. There is a huge group also in Hawaii that I worked with that use it. They have it works with repeaters and digipeaters. Works really, really well. By the way, you can use VARA on traditional analog repeaters. So you know, my dream is to use those repeaters we have in Israel to create a WhatsApp over a VHF, because everybody likes WhatsApp, as I said, right?
And those repeaters are not being used right now.
Correct. There's a bunch of guys here in Israel who already tested it. They said it works magically. So this is something I have on my to-do list. So going back to VARA. So VARA was first adopted by the WinLink project. The WinLink project support quite a few protocols. Are RDOP, WinMore, PACTOR, and VARA. VARA seems to be taking most of the bandwidth in terms of, you know, number of users, because it's affordable. It has a free version that is limited by speed. There's like 14 speed levels, if I recall. And so it takes you up to speed level 5, which is around 170 bit per second, which is good enough for chatting. Not enough for file exchange, but for chatting. And then if you want to contribute, it's not contribution. If you want to buy a license and, you know, give Jose an earning, a little bit of earning for his hard work, it costs about $69 perpetual. So that's really a no-brainer. I mean, people invest so much money in apps they don't really need, on connectors that just want to buy and put it aside just in case they need. So $69, that's really nothing. For this great piece of software. So it's software-based. All you need is a simple computer. People use very, very simple computers for this, cheap ones. You need an audio jack, and that's it. But it's only a modem. It doesn't provide you anything in terms of, you know, user experience.
Can you use this VARA modem software on your 850? Or do you have to have a rig that's more stable?
Sure, you can use it on equipment that are analog completely, that don't even have a screen. It's all you need is if you can do FT8 with it, you can do VARA with it. As simple as that.
You don't need to be with like FT8, for example. Don't you have to have maybe even some GPS lock or anything like that?
No, all you need is synchronize your time. With VARA, you don't even need that. You don't need to synchronize your time.
So even for a new initiate who doesn't have any money, and somebody gives them an FT101 or, you know, one of the old rigs, the Israel Amateur Radio Club has a whole shipping container full of silent key rigs that may be old, but they could work with this mode.
They do work. I know for sure. We have a lot of people on our community. So we have a very active forum. And people all the time post, you know, their rigs, and I see all types of rigs, sophisticated one, even ones without even a cat control. So it's preferably to have a cat control, because the system in which Vara works, it allows you to have a centralized calling frequency, but when connection is established, you can move aside and make and continue the QSO, so the calling frequency remain free for other people to call CQ and connect.
So the software will move you to the next channel.
Correct. The software will move both sides together. It's called the auto QSY mechanism that I've built. So in this way, we have like 10 slots around the central frequency. But if you don't have cat control, although most rigs from the 80s even have cat control, if you don't, then it's okay. VAR AC will put a nice pop-up on screen and say, now it's time to tune to 14.104.25 to continue. So it tells you what to do in case you don't, you can't do this automatically. But beyond that, all you need is a PTT and an audio jack. That's it.
Audio in and out to your computer, to your modem. That's the line out and the microphone in on your computer.
Yes, and nowadays you can buy on Amazon or AliExpress or whatever, those dongles who have those USB on one side. And on the other hand, you have a single jack that has four connections, like for audio and mic. This goes, and if you want to spend a little more bucks, then you have a complete soldered USB to your rig.
I've seen the VAR AC software on Windows. Does it also, will it operate on a Mac or Linux machine?
Yes, but there is a but. It is both the VARA modem. So the VARA modem itself, developed by Echo Alpha 5 HVK, it was developed and still is developed in the Visual Basic language. So Visual Basic can run on Windows. I also wrote my program in C#, which is also natively built for Windows. But there is a way, and we have a vast community who's doing it, and you can find it on the VAR AC website. There is a section on the forum called the For Linux, Mac, and Pi Users. There is a way to run those softwares on Linux and Mac using a platform called Wine. Wine is a platform that allows you to run native code from VB and C# on Linux. There are some tweaks that need to be done, but people has already created great tutorials and videos. It's all available on the website. So if you really want to, you need to spend maybe a half an hour and you'll get it up and running. I got it up and running on my end. Maybe at some point in time, I'll invest and I'll compile VAR AC in a native way for Mac and Linux. But the problem is it still relies with the VAR. The VAR modem still requires a Windows. So unless he does it, I don't have any reason to do this. But as we have a workaround, I'm not really anxious about this.
When people are thinking of, you know, a Raspberry Pi, for example, even as a way to take the VAR into the field with a smaller rig for MCOM purposes or something like that, that seems like that might make sense. But on the other hand, you're going to need an interface anyway. So I guess it could run on your Windows laptop.
Yes, most people do. So VAR AC is great mode for MCOM and for QRP operation. Unlike, for example, Pactor, where all the time they transmit, even if you don't have anything to say, because they keep in sync. With VAR, it only sends out data when there is something to send. The keep-alives happen very, very infrequently. And not only this, because of the protocol is very adaptive, there's 15 levels of speed. The first speed level can go like FT8 through minus 22 dB. So you don't need a lot of power. So if you want to make basic QSOs with VARA, with VAR AC, you can do this with 5 watts, a lousy antenna, minus 21 dBs, and you're still able to conduct the QSO that is bulletproof. No data is lost, 100% delivery.
And now this mid-show break. Every 2 weeks, I listen to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast with George, KJ6VU, Vince, VE6LK, Mark, N6MTS, Thomas, K4SWL, Michael, VA3MW, and Rod, VA3ON, and their guest on often topical and important projects in amateur radio. This discussion amongst the regulars and their guests remind me of the conversations that I used to listen to on 146.94 and 146.46 megahertz in Orange County, California, while working on my own workbench almost 50 years ago. It is amazing how much practical ham radio knowledge that we can absorb by listening to the Workbench podcast that starts to make sense when we start our own deep dive into our own projects. So join me by listening to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast now and as George and crew push beyond 200 episodes. You can get to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast by clicking on the banner in this week's show notes page. And now, back to our QSO. How large is the VARA AC user base now?
So it's now about 50K, and it's growing at a pace of about 100 to 150 a day. I know because I see all the downloads, and I see new call signs all the time. I get an email for every download, so at some point I need to make a rule on my inbox to take them aside because there are too many. As you can look on PSK Reporter, for example, so you can see how many people are active at any given moment. You have, when you filter by mode, at the top there. So VARA is right at the top with FT8, FT4, JS8, and then you'll have VARA AC.
And what's the difference, would you say, between VAR AC and JS8 call, for example? I mean, isn't that the same kind of thing? Wasn't that the same purpose?
So it has some similarities in a way. The big advantage with VAR AC, it is built specifically to create the modern WhatsApp experience in terms of UX and in terms of speed. You can send files. If you look on our Facebook group, I send my Shaq picture, the one you saw on QRZ, while chatting with people. When the conditions are good, you can get to those high speeds. You can send files. We have VMails. We have relay notifications. We have automatic QSI, QSY. So we are able to conduct, using the slot system, we're able to have multiple QSOs all together, just like JS8. But we have the benefit of speed, and we have the benefit of the UX. So those two create a real conversation, a real one, and it's not a slow one. It's a super fast one, like you have with your friends on WhatsApp. You don't have to wait 60, 1 minute, 2 minute, 5 minutes for a message to get delivered. You run a fluent chat with each other.
Can you do a roundtable mode or have multiple people in the QSO?
Yes, we have a mechanism. So there are two ways in which you can conduct a VAR AC QSO. One is the one-to-one link, and the other one is the broadcast mode. So broadcast is a new feature we introduced about 2 years ago, 1.5 years ago, that allows you to send a message to a wide audience without message delivery guaranteed. At first, it was not very popular because the SNR tolerance of this broadcast were only at the edges of minus 12 dB. So not everybody could have received. But we made a huge improvement in the last version of a month ago. That is now, a broadcast can now tolerate minus 20, minus 8, 19 dB, which makes it much more functional. So there are already quite a few groups who run the roundtables, nets, every week. There's a big group in Austria and Germany who does this. We have the official one of VAR AC. You can find the date and the frequency on our website, on the VAR AC website, rather the front page. So we have roundtables also with this mode. And I'm going to invest more into also make a delivery guaranteed mechanism into this in the next versions.
Now, are there FT8, FT4, are there specific frequencies for calling now on VAR AC?
Yeah. So you can find all the frequencies on the varachamradio.com website, varac-hamradio.com. It's all out there. And when you download the software, it is pre-populated with all the calling frequency. We have a calling frequency per band. The most popular ones are the 20 meter, which is 14.105 USB, 14.105 USB. This is where you tune your rig, right? You don't have to do any math around. Same goes for 40 meters. We have the 7.105. And then we have others, like for 10 meters is 28, 105. So we try to keep the 105 to make it easy for people to remember. But for other bands, we have some other frequencies. When you are tuned to that frequency, all you need to do, you don't have to, you turn on your beacon, letting people know you're out there. Your beacon will fire every 15 minutes. You will start to see other people's beacons appearing on screen. Then you can call a CQ. You can connect one of those beacons. People will see your beacon. It'll probably connect you. If you're not there, they will leave you a Vmail. It's a Devarace email. It's like an email. We have an internal mailing system. So they will leave you a message. When you go back to your shack, you write an email back. You don't have to connect them. It will stay in your inbox. When your station will hear their beacon, it will send them a signal. We call it the relay notification. It tells them, hey, I have a message for you. Come connect and collect it. Then they will connect and collect their message. So very simple. 14105, start there. Then start to explore the other bands because most people go there first.
Now, I heard most recently on one of the amateur radio news line shows that we get every week on podcast that some hams are being cited for operating too much bandwidth in HF. Is there any danger of exceeding bandwidth limits, maybe in the United States by the FCC or by the Ministry of Communications in Israel, in these bands using VAR-AC?
You mean like speed level, right?
Well, yeah, the higher the speed, the more bandwidth you're using in the frequency band.
So your FCC just lifted that restriction. It's now...
So the FCC in America has lifted that restriction.
Yeah, there's no more restriction in the U.S. for that speed. So, you know, people used to say that Pactor 4 was illegal in the U.S. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not a U.S. citizen. But now this regulation is off the table.
So that potentially means where all of those single sideband conversations have gone away, that VAR-AC could increase its usable bandwidth for sending pictures and data and spreadsheets and everything else.
The VAR-AC QSO, we stick to the 500 hertz bandwidth. That's it. 500 hertz. Like packet radio is around that. So we're not using any exceptional bandwidth, right? 500 hertz is very narrow. This is why we can squeeze a lot of QSOs together. But sometimes people say, hey, you guys are spreading too much with your VAR-AC. I say, hey, guys, ham radio frequencies are here to use. Rather than just not being used and only have static, we actually make good use of those frequencies. We make real conversations with people. If I could, I would have used the entire bandwidth for VAR-AC. But, you know, we still have neighbors and friends we need to live with. So... by the way, we have incorporated into the VAR-AC a mechanism to make sure that people do not step on other people's QSOs, not even for VAR-AC QSOs, even other QSOs. Like, for example, around the 14105, we have it around 14108, we have the Olivia guys. And around 14105 LSB, we have the packet radio, packet 105 network. So, you know, potentially when people move around, they can step on other QSOs. So in order to make people aware of it, we have created what we call the slot sniffer. A slot sniffer is when you want to call CQ, then you declare that you're calling CQ on the calling frequency, but you're gonna immediately QSY to slot number 3, which is, let's say, 1K up or 2Ks up. And you're going to wait for incoming connections over there. So before you call the CQ, you hit the slot sniffer, your rig temporarily QSY to that frequency, and then you can listen if it's free or not. And only if it's okay, by the way, the VAR can indicate if it's a busy channel or not, only then your CQ will fire. So we try to, you know, invest in educating our users. There you see a lot of pop-ups that tells you what to do and how to be careful around this, because we want to chat, but we don't want to ruin other people's chats, right? Even if there is in other modes.
Is there an ability, if there's a lot of conversations that are going on, to actually kind of move up the band 3, 4, 5 kilohertz?
You can move an entire band in a TSO without disconnecting the link. I've done this numerous times. Like when the propagation goes down, like for 20 meters at around 8 p.m., and I want to continue the conversation on 40 meters, for example, I can send a QSY. So we have two types of QSY mechanism. You have a QSY to a slot, or you have a free-form QSY where you can put in any frequency you want. So your VARAC will send a QSY invitation to the other side with a particular frequency. It can be on in another band. If the other side acknowledge, both of you QSY together automatically to that frequency, and the link never breaks. So you can continue where you left it.
That's so amazing, actually. Okay, so I saw on your website, beautiful as it is, by the way, and you actually have a picture of a young lady out in the shetach, out in the field, next to her four-wheel drive, operating a tablet or something like that, running VAR-AC.
People say, she's operating a VAR-AC on Mac. You don't have a Mac version. Well, it's a Shutterstock image, right? She's not a real ham radio.
You have a page for emergency communications and a very nice, beautifully laid out handout in PDF format that you can get as a picture of how the MCOM works. Has VAR-AC actually been tested under MCOM conditions, and how did that work?
Well, the MCOM community of VAR-AC has been growing rapidly in the past 12 months. People started to use it for MCOM without having any MCOM specific feature, right? Just because it was convenient, it works great on the field, it works great with low power, with lousy antennas. Its tolerance for SNR is like FT8, and you can still make a 100% bulletproof link, no data loss. So it was ideal for MCOM, especially when there's a lot of MCOM communities also running on FM. VARA also has a way to digipit itself through other VARA modems, so you can spread to a wider distance. So that MCOM community, some people from you know, there is a guy in Italy, there is a guy in the UK, there's a few guys in the US that came to me like a year ago and say, we need some specific stuff for MCOM. So I started to develop here and there some stuff. But the next version, the VAR-AC V9, which is in the oven as we speak, and I'm probably going to release it in 2 weeks, is going to have for the first time an MCOM mode. So when you tick that checkbox on the top right of your screen, you will shift your VAR-AC into an MCOM station. That comes with plenty of tools that are MCOM related. For example, your beacon will be visible as an MCOM beacon. So you can identify from all the beacons out there who are the MCOM stations. You can use alert tags. So think about this. We have an MCOM network. I'm at the headquarters. The flood is coming someplace or shifting around, or the hurricane is making its way to an area. I can send a broadcast to the area that will trigger a visual and sound effect on their VAR-ACs and will go into their alert center. So we have an alert center where all alerts are gathered. We call it an alert tags. These are predefined text tags that if you incorporate them into a message and you are able to define them and how they will affect your UX, they will make a sound, they will look different, they will have a different color, everything, and you will have everything gathered on a place called the alert center, so you don't miss an alert. That's another feature that we have that is MCOM. I'm incorporating now these ICS forms into the Vmail system. So we already have a well established Vmail system where you can send a Vmail and you can attach data and stuff. You can now include predefined templates of forms that are ICS in the ICS standard. So for the first time, we're going to have an official MCOM version. Up until now, it's still used as MCOM, but without any specific feature.
I'm sure that given natural disasters and everything else that seem to be prevalent in the world, that there'll be some actual operating time, God forbid, but there'll actually be some actually operating time on using VAR-AC for MCOM.
I can tell you a secret. There are some companies out there who has reached out to me who want to leverage VAR-AC on the field, regardless to ham radio, for real type of MCOM type of activities. So I'm exploring these opportunities.
I think that whatever commercial application that comes from amateur radio technology, it can only benefit amateur radio in the end.
Yes. Although this is not my day job, right? I have a great company. I make a good living. I don't need this for the money, but it's a hobby. But there is something good here. Commercial companies, you know, knocked my door and wanted this. So I'm exploring this as we speak.
I was so pleased and surprised to find out about you here in Israel, because I sometimes have this feeling that Israeli hams are older than I am, and I'm pretty old. It was so great to see that there's younger hams in Israel. What do you think that we could do better, maybe not just in Israel, but in general, to attract new people to the hobby?
I'll tell you what. I have a lot of criticism around how ham radio societies now work. Some do a better job than others. I think we can also do better here. Most of the ham radio societies are stuck in the old timers, in the old timers world. The main focus is talking about the history of ham radio. They glorify all the things that has been long time ago. All the great amplifiers we have built with all those fancy tubes and stuff. This is not something that intrigues the modern child nowadays, who has everything in their palm of their hand. They need something different. So you need to bridge this gap somehow. I found, for example, VAR AC to be a very intriguing toy for kids, because they see something they know in VAR AC. When the other side is typing in VAR AC, you see as an is typing message on your VAR AC. That's a modern experience they're used to. They send a picture. They see a picture. They can relate to this. So I think that, you know, ham radio need to move on, and DMR is a great foundation. But I think digital modes and like working through satellites, these are the things that are going to intrigue youngsters to get into the hobby. Not building amplifiers, right? Not doing CW is a great skill, but it's not intriguing anymore. So I don't say we should abandon this, right? But we should have this skill. We should be able to solder a resistor or a transistor. But it's not the main essence of the hobby that will intrigue youngsters. So I think we can do better over there.
Besides VAR AC, what excites you the most about what's happening in ham radio now?
Softwares. Anything that goes radio with softwares together intrigues, because everything comes to life on a big screen with all those moving things and waterfalls and gauges. So when you do software, any kind of software in ham radio, this is really something that bridges the gap between the basic type of communication and the modern world that everybody knows nowadays. So the more software there will be, the more SDRs, the more protocols, the more ways of communication that harness radio at the bottom, but at the top you'll have a laptop, an app or something. These are the things that will bring in new blood into the hobby. And I'm doing my modest contribution into this.
Arad, do you have advice that you would give to new or returning hams to the hobby?
Yes. First of all, if you already have a rig, don't throw it away. Do some effort and make it work if it doesn't work. It's part of it. It will connect you to your roots. The reason I'm still keeping the TS-850 on my desk at a prime location is because every time I touch that, I feel like I'm a 15-year-old boy. So don't throw this away. Keep it in a prime location. But then get yourself a new modern ham radio. That will revive your enthusiasm, right? Get this IC7300. Get this Chinese stuff with the waterfalls on screen, with the touch screens. It will take you to a new direction. It when it looks better, you just use it more often. As simple as that. Then start to explore. You know, do an effort and build yourself a nice antenna. A dipole is more than enough to start with. But start to explore what's going on. It took me a long time to explore. different modes, different, you know. Have you heard about free DV, for example? You can do digital audio on HF. That will intrigue you for weeks until you say, oh, it's nice. It's not functional for the day, but I spent a whole month playing with it, and that was a lot of fun. Now let's move on to another thing. Then you find you have RAC, for example. Then you find you have Winlink. Those softwares will intrigue you for a month or two every time. Then you move on to the next thing. So explore. At some point, you will find yourself hooked.
Rod, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. I have really enjoyed learning about VAR-AC. I think it's going to be the mode, once I get my generator finished, I'm going to load that into my computer and get the IC7300 operating on it, because you've really got me excited by the possibilities of having this chat mode on my HF radio. So with that so much, I want to thank you for coming on QSO today and wish you 73.
Thank you very much. 73, Eric, it was great talking to you. All the best. 73s.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Arad. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put in 4Z1AC in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, push the Sponsor Transcription button in the center of every show notes page. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing the subscribe buttons on the show notes pages. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. If listener sponsorship is not for you, then please use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on everything you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast, and it costs you nothing. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform by using Podcast Index. Use the latest Podcast 2.0 player on your smartphone to automatically get to your podcast updates as soon as we publish. I'm now using Podverse to track, manage, and listen to my podcasts. Positive comments about QSO Today on social media is appreciated, as it helps to grow our listener base. My thanks to Ben Bresky, who makes this podcaster and guests sound brilliant. Thanks, Ben. Until next time, this is Eric, 4Z1UG, 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.